Welcome to Common Sense Care, parenting your gender-confused children with truth and love. So-called affirmative care is the gender industry's one-size-fits-all answer for everyone who struggles with their identity. But in no other area of psychology, education, or medicine is one treatment plan suitable for every person. We believe that every child is an individual and should be given the care that is most appropriate for him or her. So welcome back. I'm Maria Keffler.
And I'm Erin Brewer. And what's our topic for today, Maria?
Well, today we're going to talk about ROGD, which stands for Rapid Onset Gender Dysphoria, and the social contagion aspect of that.
And this is a really relatively new phenomenon.
And I have talked to gender activists who have told me this doesn't exist. I remember the first time this happened, I was outside a school board meeting, and I recognized there was somebody waiting to speak to the school board member who was very much on the other side of the issue from me. It was about transgender policies in schools. But I thought, I'm going to open up a dialogue. So I started talking with him, and we came up to the topic of ROGD, and he said, oh, that doesn't exist. There's no such thing. I've talked to a lot of parents who said that their kids have ROGD. And I hear this all the time. Doesn't exist. It's almost like these are not the droids you're looking for.
So for those who maybe haven't heard the term rapid onset gender dysphoria or ROGD, I just want to clarify the differences. So most kids who have gender dysphoria, like me, I would have been, the DSM had not had that diagnosis when I was a kid, but I fit the criteria for gender dysphoria. And it's a very specific criteria. It usually starts in childhood and these are the kids who have been studied. These are the kids who we have data about and dissonance rates for. So we know that of the kids who develop gender dysphoria as young children, that the vast majority of them will have that gender dysphoria resolved in adolescence. Well, this is a new phenomenon where these kids don't have any symptoms of gender dysphoria at all in childhood. And then suddenly one day come home and declare a transgender identity, often really throwing parents who have not observed any, you know, gender incongruence or gender confusion throughout this child's life. And so it's very confusing for parents who suddenly are confronted with a kid who says, well, I'm actually born in the wrong body. And the parent says, well, wait a minute. There's been no indication of that until now. What's going on?
Yeah. And a lot of times what the parent hears is this litany. It's a script that's coming from this child. And I call it a script because when we talk to parents who have this experience, the kids are all saying the same thing. It's like they've been given the script. I've felt this way all my life. I hid it from you because I knew you'd be upset. I've never liked my body. I've never fit in. I've always wanted to be the opposite sex. And the parents, like you said, they're sitting there going, this just came out of the blue. Like, daughter, you were wearing skirts 3 weeks ago. You were asking me for makeup last month. What?
Well, and a lot of times it's very revisionist. So they'll like go back and find one picture where they're maybe playing with a toy that is traditionally a boy toy, or one picture, you know, if they're a boy, where maybe they're cooking, and they'll use that and they'll say, see, this is evidence. All my life, I've felt like I was born in the wrong body. And so it's very revisionist. And so for parents, it's very confusing because the parents were there, you know, throughout the childhood, and they know what the truth is. And these kids are insisting on something that isn't accurate.
Yeah. What you said about the revisionist history, we did another episode earlier about how this is a very cultic phenomenon. It has a lot of parallels with cults. And that's one of the things that cults do, is they will take their recruit and ask, well, tell me about your childhood. Oh, I had a pretty happy childhood. You know, we would go hiking on the weekends. Oh, you like hiking. Did you wear hiking boots? Oh, hiking boots are a very masculine thing. And the cult will seize upon that one picture, that one story, that one thing, and really inflate it as, oh, this is who you really are. And they kind of brush everything else off to the side. And this is a tactic that we see in cults. And we absolutely see this happening with these rapid onset gender dysphoria kids. they're getting into the GSA club, the Gender Sexuality Allies Club at school, which I have become convinced these are indoctrination centers. This is where these kids are being sucked in. They're being invited to these groups, love bombed. They're having these cult tactics applied to them. And then they're suddenly announcing, hey, I'm transgender. And when they do, they get all this celebration, all, you know. I mean, we've talked about this before. It makes total sense, right?
And I think it's important for parents to understand that these kids really believe this. They're not just making this up. They're just not pretending. They've been, as you said, indoctrinated. And so they really are believing this, which is really sad. The other thing that is really important to note is that this is happening in clusters. So one child will, you know, adopt a trans identity. The kids around them will see the celebration that's happening, the affirmation, the control that this child suddenly has, you know, teachers, parents, classmates, being able to dictate how they're treated, suddenly being catered to as far as, you know, what pronouns and names and bathrooms they're used. And then suddenly another child will announce, oh, well, I'm transgender too. And again, it sounds kind of frivolous, but I think it's important, as you said, to note that this is an indoctrination process. And so even though it might seem frivolous, it's really not. This is really dangerous because these kids are being taught to believe that they were born in the wrong body, that, you know, anybody who doesn't affirm them is an enemy, that that they deserve to have these privileges of being able to dictate the pronouns and the restrooms that they use. And so, you know, more and more kids see this. I've heard of schools where, you know, 40% of girls suddenly identify as transgender out of the blue. That's absurd. You know, this is, if this were any other kind of, you know, something, you know, illness or any other psychological incident that was happening, this would be alarming to say the least. You know, this would be beyond a pandemic, you know. people would be just completely freaked out if suddenly we had, you know, autism at this kind of rate, or if we had, you know, OCD at this kind of rate, or if we had, you know, really any other kind of issue kind of popping up in clusters like this and increasing it at the rate that it's increasing and requiring the kind of medical interventions that these people are saying that they need. Again, this would be considered, you know, a public health crisis. Instead, it's being considered something to celebrate, which is, again, an indication that it's a cult.
Yeah. And what you will hear the schools say is we're just following best practices. So like the American Academy of Pediatrics, they wanted to issue a policy statement on transgender medicine. So they asked this team of doctors, team of 37 people sat down and wrote this policy statement. The two head doctors, the head writer and the head consultant, both have financial ties to gender clinics. So this was a very special interest team that put this together. Their statement was not vetted by the other 60,000 doctors who are part of the American Academy of Pediatrics. It was this team who said, hey, we're specialists in this. This is what we say. Well, they say what's beneficial to doctors who work in gender clinics, because doctors who work in gender clinics get no money from telling a child, no, you're perfectly healthy the way you are, go see a psychiatrist to deal with your mental health issues. They don't make any money off that. They make money off the child who wants to take the puberty blockers, who wants to take the cross-sex hormones, who wants to have the surgeries. So what you'll hear in the school is we're just following best practices, but those best practices are very special interest practices that have been very strategically promulgated and placed to make it seem like they're based on research.
Right.
And they're not.
They're not evidence-based.
No,
that's
The Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, they've got this model school district policy that's being very strategically, aggressively forced into schools. In my state, Virginia, local interest groups around transgender policies have asked the state legislature to tell them which school boards have not adopted the school district policy so that they can go and apply pressure in those schools. I'm getting a little far afield here, but that policy has three resources cited for support. Two of them originated with GLSEN.
Wow.
That's just like the big tobacco companies saying, we're going to hire somebody to do a study to find out if nicotine is bad for you. Right. Oh, nicotine's not bad for you.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's really shocking. And one of the things that people need to understand is that we don't have longitudinal studies about ROGD. In fact, Lisa Littman, who was the one who first sort of coined the term rapid onset gender dysphoria, she published her study and actually, talk about people being anti-science. The transgender activists just went crazy about this, and it was taken down. The study was, sort of analyzed, was, under a fine-tooth comb, and turned out it was very solid research, and it was republished. But that just goes to show they're not interested in science. They're interested in this ideology. We do have longitudinal studies about children with gender dysphoria, and we know that the vast majority of them will outgrow it. This rapid onset gender dysphoria is such a new phenomenon that we don't really know what the trajectory is, but we are seeing desisters, starting to emerge, who are saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe I was allowed to do this. These are kids often who have, underlying issues that we've talked about. Oftentimes these are kids who really are struggling socially. They have, potentially they're being bullied. They are really in need of feeling affirmed, of feeling celebrated, of feeling validated. These are the kids that are being attracted to this ideology. And so, as they're moving through high school and then getting out there in the world and realizing what a sham this ideology is, they're desisting and they're speaking out and they're saying, how on earth was I allowed to run with this idea? How on earth was I allowed to be given puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and surgeries that permanently medicalized and damaged me? And they're enraged. They are just incredibly outraged that they were allowed to do this. And so I think that we're going to have more and more of this happening if we are going to continue this affirmation model that is being pushed by activists.
If I were any sort of a therapist, a counselor, a licensed therapist, a psychiatrist, right now, I would be building a practice around detransitioners, because we're hearing from detransitioners that they do not have resources. When they leave the cult, they are cut off. The doctors who were so happy to support them toward medicalization won't take their phone calls. The therapists who agreed with them that, yes, you are the opposite sex and we need to get you medicalized, they've got nothing to offer. And we're hearing this from detransitioners. So if you're a therapist, I would start building a therapy plan around supporting detransitioners and the trauma that they've been through. Again, yeah. That's a side issue. But I'm really concerned for all of these detransitioners who are telling us we don't have any help. There's nobody to help us.
Yeah. And the thing that's so frustrating about this is that we know that there is such a thing as social contagion. This is a well-documented thing that happens, especially among teenagers. It's not like this is hitting us out of the blue and we've never experienced this before. Any teacher who has ever worked with teenagers, any parent who's ever had a teenager has experienced this. This is something that, advertising and marketers thrive on, is this social contagion. This is something that's very well known. And in fact, one of the things that's really concerning to me is that suicide can also be a social contagion. And one of the things that trans activists are doing is saying that if we don't affirm these kids, they're going to commit suicide. So in essence, what they're doing is that they're introducing the social contagion of gender dysphoria, and then they're introducing sort of the secondary social contagion of suicide, which is incredibly dangerous, just to sort of be promulgating to children the idea that if you're not affirmed, the appropriate response is suicide. And so we have a couple of clips here that talk about social contagion and how easy it is for kids to influence one another, and how this is well documented. This is something that we know happens. And so we should be looking critically at it rather than celebrating it as, you know, a new, as kids, finding their authentic selves.
Brian, you've been looking at social contagion. Tell us about your research.
We know that social influence generally exists. We're influenced by the people we have relationships with.
How do we more effectively lead change then?
So the practical advice is you identify who are the core spreaders in an organization, right? So if you can identify, much like you would in public health, who are the core spreaders of a disease, who are the core spreaders of influence and behavior in organizations? And what we found in my research is that you can identify these core spreaders using data such as, the server logs from your email system, right? And you can actually use social network analysis methods to identify who are the core spreaders. And if you target these core spreaders, right, then you can actually have this contagion process diffuse, so that if you're trying to, you're trying to have a change effort where you're trying to promote adoption of certain kinds of behaviors, you want staff to participate in webinars or these kind of things to support change efforts, targeting these core spreaders is a really good way to change behaviors.
Groupthink is the narrowing of thought in a group by which its members come to believe that there is only one possible correct answer. Moreover, in a groupthink mentality, to even suggest alternatives is a sign of disloyalty to the group. Another way of understanding group conformity is to think about reference groups. Reference groups are groups we use as standards to judge ourselves and others. What's normal for you is determined partly by your reference groups. In-groups are reference groups that you feel loyalty to and that you identify with. But you can compare yourself to out-groups too, which are groups that you feel antagonism towards and which you don't identify with.
Social contagions are well documented. This is very normal. It happens. Even back in the 1800s, a book came out. It was The Sorrows of Young Werther, and I can't remember who wrote it. But it was this book that was very popular among teens. And there was this wave of suicides because in the book, a character commits suicide. And they started finding all of these kids committing suicides. I mean, we know that this happens. And not all social contagions are bad. I mean, there are some social contagions that are neutral, like yawning. Right before we started this video, I yawned, and then
I was like, "Oh no!"
Yawn. And I'm starting to think about yawning just because.
Yeah, and I remember in elementary school, I started bringing bouillon cubes to nibble on during class, and within a week, everybody was bringing bouillon cubes to nibble on. It was just
healthy.
Yeah. I mean, it was just weird. And it sort of came and went. And then, somebody else brought cinnamon toothpicks. We kind of went through that phase and everybody wanted cinnamon toothpicks. And
we had a toothpick craze too.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Pockets, we had combs. Everybody had to have a comb in their back pocket. That was like cool for a while. And so I think, tweens and teens are very susceptible to these contagions because they want to fit in. They want to be like the other kids. They want to be cool. And so something like rapid onset gender dysphoria or a trans identity where, suddenly you can go from being like the most bullied, the most marginalized kid in the group to being popular and powerful and cool. It's not surprising that it's catching on. To me, it makes perfect sense. The absurdity is that we're embracing this and suggesting that, this is a child who suddenly we say it was born in the wrong body. And again, to me, it almost is counter to the whole ideology, because here's a kid who clearly wasn't suggesting that they were trans identified until suddenly they are. And yet the transgender movement is saying you're born in the wrong body. So again, it sort of even counteracts their ideology. So they have to come up with this whole backstory about how the kid always knew they were born in the wrong body. They just were afraid to tell anybody, even though there was absolutely no indication of that. In a lot of ways, it reminds me of the false memory craze that sort of happened in the late 80s and 90s, you know, where this idea that you could have repressed memories that even you wouldn't know about. And if you thought that you had repressed memories, but you couldn't remember anything, that was evidence that you had repressed memories. I mean, it was this very convoluted ideology that's very easy to suck kids into.
Yeah. I think in a few years, we're going to look back on this period of the transgender craze. And I think we're going to look at it the same way people are looking at repressed memories and looking at split personality, which that happens. But it was this big craze where suddenly everybody had a split personality, or the way we look back at lobotomies and say, oh, how did we do that to anybody? And incidentally, the doctor who pioneered lobotomies was given, was it a Nobel Prize for science for that?
Right. And so when you hear people say, well, doctors wouldn't do something if it weren't correct. Well, guess what? Doctors used to recommend cigarettes. I remember seeing ads where doctors would be smoking cigarettes. And, you know, if you had a sore throat, go get a menthol cigarette. It'll help soothe your throat. So doctors,
well, where did Coca-Cola come from, right? Right. Coca-Cola used to have cocaine in it.
Right.
And people said, oh, it's so good for you.
Right.
And the laudanum, was it laudanum?
Laudanum, yeah.
1800? Yeah. Oh, just take some laudanum and you'll feel better.
Yeah, not to mention the opioid crisis, which is killing, you know, people all around the world. And so the idea that doctors would never do something that is harmful is just absurd. We have, you know, ample evidence to show that that's not correct. The doctors historically do make huge mistakes. And that's one of the reasons that we need to be critical of them. This is one case where we're told, nope, you're not allowed to question it. You're not allowed to, you know, and any evidence such as Lisa Lippman's study, or, you know, recently there was another study that came out that showed, again, this longitudinal study, and I'll post it in the description below, but it was, you know, another one that Ken Zucker was involved with, that, you know, longitudinal study that showed that I think it was 87% of kids with gender dysphoria desist if they're allowed to naturally progress through childhood. Those studies are being silenced, you know, and discredited, and they're coming up with these absurd, you know, retrospective self-reporting studies from activists that, you know, sort of, you know, are completely methodologically flawed to substantiate their claims that this is how we should be treating gender, you know, these rapid onset gender dysphoric kids. Or in your case, they'll deny that it even happens. And they'll say, oh, this wasn't rapid onset gender dysphoria. These kids were just too scared to ever mention it. Sort of like Ellen Page, I guess, who came out recently, and now she's saying she just never felt comfortable being her authentic self. Well, that's absurd.
Yeah, I read an article, I think it was in People, about Ellen Page, who's now calling herself Elliot Page. And I read it, and it was just a complete revisionist history. It told stories that, you know, never heard that before. Oh, when Ellen was was 9 years old, you know, he knew that he really was supposed to be a boy. And I'm like, Ellen Page was a beautiful woman who played a pregnant teenager, who played a girl who liked to rollerblade instead of be, you know, a beauty queen. She was such a role model for gender nonconforming people. And now I just look at that and I'm just heartbroken for her. Heartbroken for her.
To even entertain the idea that you can be born in the wrong body, like that you can know that you're born in the wrong body, and that we're going to accept that as a truth is so concerning. Because really, you can believe that you think, that you wish that you were something you're not, but you can't ever know what it feels like to be something you're not. And that's kind of the crux of the problem here, is that none of these kids actually know what it feels like to be something they're not. And we're saying, oh, actually, yes, they can know what it feels like to be something they're not. And if we're going to allow that to happen, then we're going to have to allow people who can identify as different ages than they actually are, different races than they actually are, different nationalities than they actually are. Heck, I'm going to identify as having Bill Gates and Oprah Winfrey as my parents, because I want their inheritance. I mean,
it's So does that mean they need to accept that? Because right. That's how you identify.
Exactly.
I think it was Colin Wright who said, we cannot afford to lose our collective tether on reality. Mm-hmm. Reality has physical truths to it. Mm-hmm. Your body is a physical truth. And I just want to encourage parents, if you have a child who's suffering with ROGD, listen to your gut. You know your child. Step back and ask yourself, does this make sense? If you can silence all the voices that are telling you you're a bad parent if you don't affirm this, just step back and ask yourself, what is true? My child never indicated this in 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years. This came out of the blue. Does your child have something else going on? The Littman study underscored that so many of these kids have autism. They've got prior trauma. They're suffering depression. They're suffering self-harm. They're suffering eating disorders. The kids who are doing this are generally not the happy, healthy kids that everything's going great with them. These are the marginalized kids.
Yeah.
And that's horrifying to me that we're telling.
Sometimes they're even just girls who are going through puberty who are incredibly uncomfortable with it, as is normal, as every generation of girls has been historically. So some of these kids do have trauma. Some of these kids are autistic. Some of them are marginalized, but some of them are just perfectly normal girls who are uncomfortable with going through puberty and are being told that if you're uncomfortable with puberty, it means that you're actually born in the wrong body.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. I don't want to make it sound like, oh, if you have a child with no other concurrent issues, you don't need to worry. Mm. If your child's in the culture today, you need to be concerned about this because they really are pushing this on all kids.
It's such a difficult time because, you know, teenagers need society to help provide them with boundaries and to help kind of guide them. And we're really doing a huge disservice right now to all of our teenagers as we're embracing this ideology.
Well, and we talked in an earlier episode too about locus of control. Mm-hmm. And people tend to either have an internal locus of control, which means they feel like I have some power over my life. I can choose to make changes that will affect my life. Somebody with an external locus of control feels that they have no power. All the power is outside. All they can do is react to what other people are doing to them. And this transgender ideology is all about that external locus of control. Going back to what you said about the therapists and the gender industry telling kids, if you're not affirmed, you're going to be suicidal. That puts the locus of control out absolutely outside yourself. I cannot help but want to kill myself if somebody misgenders me. That's ridiculous. Yeah. That's ridiculous. People have suffered such horrible atrocities. Yeah. They've been in concentration camps. They've suffered abuse. They've suffered under dictatorships. And they have survived because the human spirit is very resilient unless you teach it that it's not.
And I'm so glad you brought that up because I think that's critical for people to understand that the activists are the ones who are contributing to the suicide rate. They're the ones who are telling kids that it's an appropriate response to kill yourself if you're not affirmed. Because as you said, humans are incredibly resilient if they're taught to be resilient. Humans can, you know, endure incredible suffering. Not that this even is, you know, anywhere near that. But as you said, you know, the concentration camps, the man's search for meaning, you know, we have this sense of, you know, slaves who have endured just horrible, horrible physical and emotional distress, and they haven't been compelled to kill themselves. It's only because it's like we're encouraging kids. It's almost like, well, if you don't get what you want, the best response is to kill yourself. Imagine telling that to a child in any other circumstance. You know, if your parents don't let you drive the family car, Yeah, go ahead and kill yourself. That's probably what you should do. I mean, imagine, is there any other situation where we would encourage children to kill themselves? I hear doctors and I hear, you know, people testifying in front of legislators saying that if, you know, if we pass laws that will prevent children from medically transitioning, children will kill themselves. Well, guess what? That's contributing to the social contagion. Those people are now culpable for any suicides that happen because they are planting that idea in these children's heads. And we know that suicide is a social contagion because, you know, that book you mentioned, and we've also seen it time and time again. We've even had new media guidelines on how to talk about suicide because we have seen suicide being a social contagion over and over and over again. And now we have transgender activists who are embracing it and encouraging it. And to me, that is just a travesty. And I don't know how people are sitting back and allowing it to happen.
Yeah, what you said about suicide being a social contagion reminded me when I was in high school, there was a girl in the class behind me who committed suicide. And it was tragic. That was the first time I ever thought, oh, is that something that, like, your life can be so bad that you want to kill yourself? And I have mentioned in a previous video that I had postpartum depression after one of my children was born, and I needed to be under a doctor's care for about a year. And I remember talking to that psychiatrist and telling him that that was the first time that I had ever thought about suicide. Feeling suicidal is one of the problems that I had related to the postpartum depression. And the psychiatrist told me, he said, that's very normal when somebody in your circle commits suicide to be thinking about that. He said, if that perseveres and continues, that shows there's something, there's a problem that needs to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. To just think about it a little bit, that's normal. Mm-hmm. And that makes me think, okay, so we're employing that normal suggestiveness. Mm-hmm. We're almost weaponizing that social contagion, that power of suggestion, mm-hmm. and weaponizing it against our children. Mm-hmm. Why would we do this? Who benefits from this?
Yeah, it's horrible. I've even heard activists, you know, threaten legislators saying if a child kills themselves, it's their blood on your hands. And I'm like, nope, that's gaslighting in the extreme. It's actually on your hands because you're the ones telling kids that they are so fragile, that they're so vulnerable, that the only way they can live is if they're affirmed in the way that you're telling them they need to be affirmed.
Well, I talked to one mom who was at the pediatrician's office with her child, and the child said something about being transgender in the pediatrician's office, and the mom was not on board with it. And she said, you know, we're treating, I don't remember what all she said, but she was not a, oh yay, this is wonderful. And the pediatrician turned to the mother and said, how are you going to feel if your child commits suicide because you didn't affirm?
And I'm assuming the child heard that.
Oh yeah, right in front of the child, yeah. Right in front of the child.
Again, planting the idea that if the mother doesn't affirm her, that it's an appropriate response. It's just, it's ridiculous. So we have two very significant social contagions going on here. First of all, the rapid onset gender dysphoria, and then the suicide as a way to manipulate people. And again, this is a social contagion. So we are going to see an increase in suicides because children are being encouraged to accept that suicide is an appropriate response, which is—
Well, I think we're already seeing that increase.
Yeah. And in fact, the interesting thing is as we're seeing an increase in affirmation of transgender identities, we're also seeing an increase in suicide. And so to me, that's very indicative to, you know, it suggests that the affirmation is not the appropriate response. It's not going to prevent suicides. It's actually increasing them.
Because if it were true that this is just people's normal state that's finally being allowed to come out because society is accepting it. Mm-hmm. If that were true, we would be seeing suicides going down. Exactly. We would also be seeing concurrent rates between boys and girls.
Right.
Instead of this huge shift to the enormous numbers of girls who are doing it. Mm-hmm. Why are we not seeing those same numbers in boys? Boys are doing it, not at the same rate as girls are. Why aren't we seeing this, as Abigail Schreier pointed out, why aren't we seeing this in 40-year-old women, 50-year-old women, 60-year-old women? Mm-hmm. If there's been so much latent, hidden transgenderism, it should be coming out everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's coming out primarily in teens and very young adults.
Yeah. So do we have a question from a parent for this episode?
We do. We have one question. My daughter's whole peer group has announced that they're all transgender. No one at school seems to find anything strange about this. How do I deal with this? It's obviously a social trend they're trying on. If it were just different hair and clothes, that would be fine. But three of them are already on hormones.
Oh, wow. Imagine. I mean, I can't even, if that many kids in a group suddenly, you know, claimed to be autistic or claimed to have obsessive compulsive disorder.
Or they'd all been abducted by aliens.
Right. Yeah. Or that they were, yeah, I mean, basically abducted by aliens is very much, I mean, I can't imagine how school officials are just sitting back and not concerned about this at all. And I think the mother has every right to be very concerned, because the treatment for this is something that's going to damage the child.
I think in that case, I would do everything I could as a parent to get that child out of that school and unfortunately out of that friend group.
Yeah, I think that that's really, in a case like this, the best approach. And again, I liken it to drugs. If there were a group of five kids who were all doing drugs and your child was part of that peer group, it's going to be really hard to get them off drugs unless you pull them completely out. You know, if they're all, you know, shooting up heroin during lunchtime, there's nothing you can do as a parent to stop that unless you physically remove them from that friend group, which is incredibly devastating to kids to have that happen. But I think that it's worth that kind of an intervention to save your kids from this ideology.
Yeah. I talked to a youth director at a youth program a year or so ago, and we were talking about this issue of kids presenting as transgender. And she talked about having seen parents whose kids were in various crises, whether it was, got pregnant, were involved in drugs, were self-harming, some sort of a crisis. And she said in her experience, when parents did the drastic thing of pulling the child out of that environment, she said, I've seen parents move their kids to a different, pack up the family and move. One family I'd heard just took a year and took a road trip. Not everybody can do that, but the parents were able to take some time off work, or they worked from the road, I don't know, and just got an RV and we're just going on a road trip for a year, just to get the child out of that. And this youth director said, in every case that she knew of, the parents who did that drastic thing saved their kid. She said, it's the parents who just say, let's just wait and see, let's just stay the course and hope it gets better. Yeah. Those are the ones that tend to have the bad outcomes.
Yeah. And it's hard as a parent doing those drastic things. It can be really, especially because initially the kid's going to be mad. And so you're going to be dealing with a child who's extremely difficult for a while, but I think in the long run, it's worth it. And it will settle down. You just have to be able to weather it for the first few months when that child's going to be really angry.
And you do need to weigh the cost of it. Wow. I think about, you know, kids who are very angry, you may have a child who runs away. Mm-hmm. You may have a child who self-harms. There is a cost. If you choose to homeschool, probably one of the parents is going to have to either quit working or cut back on work in order to homeschool. Yeah. So I don't want this to sound like we're glibly saying, oh, just pull them out and homeschool and it'll all be fine. I mean, there's a cost that comes to it, but you really do need to weigh, what is it worth the cost of perhaps my child going down the medicalization route and spending the rest of his or her life medicalized?
Yeah. And at the very least, I would encourage parents in a situation like this to meet with the school and to bring in some resources like the school policy guide that that is now out. We'll post a link to it down below. And provide them with some resources, because some schools may not know an alternative to affirmation. So they might just be going along with this because they think this is the only option. And so it's possible that you could meet with a school and potentially maybe influence the policy. I think that's kind of hopeful given the climate that we're in, but it's always worth a try, I think. And the other thing is if you can't homeschool, is to get them into a different school, just to get them into a different peer group, I think will really help. Maybe think of getting them into some extracurricular activities that will get them, you know, associated with different kids. Because again, those peer groups can be so powerful, and the influence they have can be, it's really hard to, you know, to change that if the kid is around those kids all the time. So there are some options other than, you know, completely pulling them out. But again, I think that ultimately, you know, I've talked to lots of parents, and the ones who are having success with turning their kids around are the ones who have pulled their kids from school.
I agree. I'm seeing the same thing. It's the parents who are treating this as a cult.
Yeah.
And who are actively trying to get their kids' allegiance back with the family.
Yeah.
Because the kids' allegiance has now been given to the trans activism.
Right.
And treating it as a cult and really trying to sever those unhealthy influences seem to be what's turning things around for families.
Yeah, boy, another heavy topic, Maria.
No, another one, yeah. So please come to our website, partnersforethicalcare.com. We have resources there. We have a 24-hour chat line. We have limited numbers of agents. So if you get in the chat and nobody picks up right away, send us an email. Somebody will get back to you. But we have that chat line open 24/7. Next week, we are going to talk about the adolescent mind.
Oh, boy, do I remember that.
I think this will be a fun topic. I love tweens and teens. They're just my people. And so I love to just think about and talk about kind of how they work and how they think.
It's so important to remember how different their thought processes are. You know, oh my gosh. So that'll be an interesting topic.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks so much, Erin. It's always good to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to next week.
All right. Thanks, Maria.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We are not doctors or therapists. We are not giving medical or psychiatric advice, and we offer no guarantee of outcomes. We simply want to talk about how to support and love kids using long understood best practices from the fields of psychology, education, and child development. We're glad you joined in our conversation today, and we hope that you took away something you can put in your toolkit for parenting your gender-confused kids with truth and love.